It's time for Comment, Please, by Univest. Marking 50 years of serving Montgomery and Bucks counties, cited by the Associated Press, Pennsylvania Association of Broadcasters, Society of Professional Journalists, and the Philadelphia Press Association for excellence in broadcasting. Here's the host of Comment Please by Univest, Darryl Berger.
Good afternoon and welcome to Comment Please by Univest. On this Friday afternoon, we have an opportunity to spend some time with another local state lawmaker. We've had a number of state legislators on the program recently. We had Matt Fox in here. We were talking about the former officer, Matt Bradford, we had in here earlier this week. Of course, Matt Fox, the name of an officer that was slain, and I want to talk about gun control, and that ties into some of the issues because we have state legislator Mike Varib on the program today. And, Mike, first of all, thanks for the time. I appreciate your being here.
Glad to be here, Darryl.
And I got Matt Bradford confused with Brad Fox, who was the officer that was slain, and there are gun control issues. It's hot now all over the country. I don't know how hot it is in Pennsylvania. I want to talk about some of those things with you. And you've got a unique perspective because you're not just a state lawmaker, but you're a former police officer. So you're familiar with guns. You know how criminals use guns. And I think, you know, we've politicized this issue so much. You have politicians talking about stuff they don't know what they're talking about. I've said on this program, I don't know a lot about guns because I'm not a gun owner. But what's your take on the whole gun issue in Pennsylvania or just in general?
Well, you hit on a hot-button issue in the gun argument, and that is politicians talking about things that they have no idea what they're talking about with guns. I'll give you an example. Restricting clips to 10 rounds.
Right.
That eliminates probably 60% of the handguns that people own in Pennsylvania. Handguns have 15-round clips, not 30, not 20, not 25, and they require the trigger to be pulled each time.
So you can't just hold the trigger.
No, you have to pull the trigger each time for each round. So when you start hearing people saying, let's limit it to 10 rounds, well, then why don't we limit it to one round? Like, why don't we go back to the one shooter, for crying out loud? I think we need to focus on this issue of gun debate. Of course, it's politically charged.
Sure.
Because political people are trying to make it charged. We have to focus on really what's going on here. And there's not one proposal yet that I've heard, not one, that would have stopped a Connecticut shooting, that would have stopped Brad Fox from being shot, and it would all these tragedies, the city of Philadelphia, and what they're going through, and the commissioner's overwhelming issues he deals with the guns of Philadelphia. All of us recognize there's a problem,
mm-hmm.
But the problem really is the criminals. I mean, I've yet to see. I look at yesterday, Philadelphia Airport. We have a law-abiding citizen with a permit go to board a plane with a weapon. Accidentally, they deal with it. They take the gun. Person has a license to carry. It was an accident. Behind that person, an hour or so later, in the same terminal, a person comes through unlicensed, illegally possessing a .357 Magnum. Now, you tell me, how do we deal with a six-shooter .357 Magnum boarding an airplane about to be at 33,000 feet, you know, cruising across our country? So, look, this debate needs to happen. You know, the background check is a very viable issue. We have to look to make sure that people have background checks, and you know, certainly that system's working now, but I know there's a private sale issue. That's a conversation that certainly can be had. But when we start restricting, you know, based on some political talking point of a 10-round clip, I think you're going to, once people realize that the guns that they have in their homes that are just there locked up to protect themselves at home,
yeah,
not even a hunters of the world, I think you're going to get the ire of another level of people, really hugging on to the Constitution, and that is their right to bear arms. Not everybody in this Commonwealth and not everybody in this country owns firearms and hangs them on the back of their truck when they go hunting. And, you know, some do it for personal protection, and you know, the hunters have their reasons and want their protections, and we have to look at it all. We have to look at the law-abiding citizen and protect them from this process.
Clearly, there are some people that want guns off the streets altogether. Guns are part of the culture. Guns are part of our history. We're not going to eradicate them. They're not going away. They're here. And I always sort of always defer to the cops, who I hear being very ambivalent generally toward a lot of the gun control talk because they think it's more politics than it is reality.
Well, and there's not too many people. In fact, I don't know that there's anyone in that Capitol building while there are former cops, and I'm sure my good friend Joe Hackett from Delaware and Mr. Costa from Allegheny, I know myself, I've been unfortunate to be greeted with an AK-47 on the other side of a door of a search warrant when I was a cop.
Mm-hmm.
Look, we take this seriously. We don't think guns are a joke, and we don't think gun ownership is a joke. But when we start having talking points controlling this conversation rather than reality, I think that that's where we're going to lose focus. Look, aren't we in this to protect people's lives? So how are we going to do this? I mean, first off, you look at a problem in Philadelphia, the last couple of cops shot and mortally wounded, were parole mix-ups, okay? We are working on parole reform unrelated to the Rob case here that we'll talk about, I'm sure. But we're working on, and so is the parole board. They don't want to let people out on the street that shouldn't be back on the street. And It's exactly what happened in Philadelphia. The governor had ordered an investigation, and the parole board is reviewing what happened. So you have an aspect there. The other part is, how are these bad guys getting guns? And if you look at the Brad Fox case, this is a white-collar criminal who was a convicted felon who was purchasing guns in a parking lot of a gun store 1/4 mile from my home, an upscale, decent, retired cop running the gun store. They followed the law, but someone was going in there purchasing the guns for this guy. And I think he had up to like 7 guns that he bought at that store over a period of time, for this criminal who then ultimately used it to mortally wound Officer Brad Fox.
And so there's been a legislation that was passed. Marcy Topol was involved there was a big signing. That kind of closes a loophole as it relates to straw purchases.
Well, what it did, actually, Marcy had run that bill over to the Senate prior to Brad being killed. We ended up dubbing it the Brad Fox Law in his memory because it was definitely the closest illustration we could ever get to what Marcy was trying to accomplish. And that was, you do it once, you're a criminal. You do it twice, 3 times, 4 times, you need to pay supreme prices for all those excessive purchases. In this case, if the law had been in place when these purchases had gone, had been done, there'd be even more of a mandatory laying on the head of that criminal that killed Brad Fox.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, Marcy worked hard on that. We got it signed in the law, and we have to continue to look at all of the avenues of straw purchase, because from guns not being secured at home, you talk about lost and stolen, from the guns that are out in the streets that people don't even know they're missing, to the ones that are stolen out of stores or stolen at gun shows, the truckloads of or trucks get stolen at gun shows, and the relativity to how we are getting those guns reported so that we know that that those guns are on the street is critical. It's something to definitely look at. I just wish that we could have a constructive, non-political conversation about guns, just like we do for every other criminal code issue that we deal with. It's not just guns that kill people. Drunk drivers kill people. We deal with that. We continue to reduce the alcohol content of people driving. Why do we make cars that travel? Why are speedometers at 120 in our cars? A speed limit, the highest in Pennsylvania, is 65. So I don't want to compare them, but we really do this with every other aspect of our crime scope. We vet it out, and our goal is to protect people in Pennsylvania.
And you mentioned the Raphael Rubb, and you're involved in an issue there, a parole issue, and I want to get to that. But is there any legislation, any gun-related issue in terms of the types of guns or background checks or anything that you see likely to move through the state legislature?
Not very quickly. I think that, first of all, in the Judiciary Committee, this legislation had failed. There's a Republican and Democrat chairman in this case. The Republicans are in charge in the House. But even when they were in charge before, it could not get out of committee. Governor Rendell came in front of the Judiciary Committee under a Democrat-led House, brought police officers' widows, brought police officers that had been shot on duty and survived, brought a series of people, Pittsburgh, and they still couldn't get this legislation out of the committee. This is not a Republican-Democrat issue as much as the Democrat National Committee would like to make it. Perhaps they can convince Senator Reid to actually do something. It is not a political issue. Democrats like guns, like Republicans, and they like the Second Amendment, like Republicans. This is a conversation that's got to be more practical, focused on the issues, and focused on protecting the real issue here, and that is criminals and how these guns are getting in their hands. And I'm open to that conversation.
And it's so easy to politicize that politicians want to latch onto it real quick and politicize it. And their issues of privacy, the criminals are a threat. But obviously, you talk about the Connecticut situation or the shooting in Colorado and Aurora. They weren't hardened criminals that committed those. There were people with mental issues, obviously. So you've got that issue and then the privacy issues that tie into that. it's really a complicated morass of things.
Yeah, I just don't want to hear R versus D. If Senator Reid's not willing to move the ban bill out of the Senate, the United States Senate, then why should anyone else be pointing to Republicans? And it's a very serious issue. It's a duty that I take seriously. Regardless of my personal feelings, I have an obligation to look at both sides of this conversation. I will continue to do that. But I will tell you, 2-1 easy, 2-1 easy. And emails and communications with my office are people to protect the Second Amendment of our Constitution. It's actually the highest generated amount of traffic bill or potential legislation that I've had.
So, Raphael Rabb, just give me the overview of that story for people that haven't heard it. It's been rather prominent in this region, and what kind of legislation you're proposing.
Raphael the Thug Rob is a certified trained manipulator. He bludgeoned his wife to death, staged a burglary. Brought the daughter back to the crime scene. She got to see the crime scene where her mother was killed. This is many years ago, I'll say 6 or 7 years ago. I forget the exact date now. Back then, our district attorney, Bruce Castor, had, you know, worked on a case. They ended up coming up with a guilty plea in the case only because I understand at the time there's a lot of evidence issues, and he felt that the best thing at the time was to plead the case to manslaughter. So the judge sentenced him to 5 to 10 years. Now, you would think, even though he was not, you can't get a murder sentence out of a manslaughter conviction, when the judge sentenced somebody from 5 to 10 years, you know, the average thought process is they're going to do 7, maybe 8, hopefully 10. Mr. Rob applied for parole and was given parole, and he was due to get out in 3 weeks. And Ellen's brother, Gary, who lives out of town, and frankly, when she was killed, he had come to town to help her move out of her house because of the domestic violence issues and the divorce that was impending.
Mm-hmm.
And Gary pulled up that morning to see his sister in a body bag. So when his parole happened, he engaged the media. He engaged our district attorney, who was very involved in writing letters in opposition to this departure of Mr. Rob. And frankly, I saw it, and I wonder what happened. I mean, got immediate contact with our governor, asked him to help me out to get in touch with his parole board to see what we can do to have his case re-reviewed, which is exactly what the parole board agreed to do. And they did it because there's new information. And that was a letter from the sentencing judge, Paul Tressler, who said this guy is the definition of max. He is the one that should be in there for 10 years. And there was other added testimony that I'm not privileged to, that the family provided to the parole board, at which his parole was revoked. The bottom line is the scales of justice through our criminal justice system always provide the opportunity for the Commonwealth to put a case versus the defense, right? In that Commonwealth or in that defense case, we have character witnesses. We have our victims. Since when should our process cut the victims off post-sentencing? This guy sits in jail before he's paroled. The parole board members go and meet with him in prison. Are you okay, Mr. Rob? You ready to go back? Is society ready for you? Yes, of course he is. And the victim can just submit handwritten testimony. Now, you know as well as I do, to sit there and read the Philadelphia Inquirer or any other publication versus witnessing or being in front of people trying to tell the story, there is an impact when a person's face-to-face. The current system does not allow for victims to appear in front of the parole board. My legislation, House Bill 492, which left Judiciary, Appropriations, and the House floor, left unanimously every committee and the House floor and was sent to the Senate. Senator Greenleaf, I understand, is going to be moving a bill, hopefully through the Senate, and we hope to, with a couple technical changes, have it signed into law by the break here for the budget. That allows victims to have, it's their right to appear in front of the parole board. They don't have to, but it is their right and their obligation to say no if they don't want to appear in front of the parole board.
Obviously, the Rob case is what motivated you to move the legislation. Do you believe that there's a broader impact of this legislation, though, and that there are cases out there, maybe you've heard from some people, where they were denied an opportunity that they would have taken advantage of?
Not only were they denied an opportunity, they didn't even know it was an option.
Hmm.
There's a clause in the current law that calls for a conference call that most victims that I've talked to didn't even know about. It's important to note that our current parole board chairman, which Governor Corbett appointed, Mr. Pottinger, about a year and a half ago, had worked on this with the victim advocate for the last year because they actually thought that these in-person interviews would be better. They're very supportive, as are all of the groups, or victim groups across our Commonwealth. And when I say all, right, it's a big umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the bigger ones that we deal with day to day, they all support the legislation, as does our DA, the State DA's Association. Look, they want the victims to have a voice. And yes, this was prompted by Ellen Rob and this tragic case of Mr. Raphael Rob getting ready to walk out of the prison.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, it's just giving our victims the same access to the system that our criminals do. And I think that once the parole board knew that he was still harassing the 18-year-old daughter, harassing her financially from prison, I think that that might have had an impact on keeping him there.
I think there is this perception that, you know, we created a system that really protected the rights of the guilty parties, the criminals. We and now we're sort of working on victims' rights, and this sort of goes to that. The victims are families.
Look, there's two sides of the scale. I mean, justice is obviously a two-party system. It's a balance of an act versus our victims, and you know, our courts have to go through that process. But you're right. It's okay to worry about the rights of the defendants or the criminals, and I think that those rights are important. But I also think it's important that when the tears dry up and the years go by and the wounds scab over, that our victims still have that right if they deem necessary. Imagine this guy committing murder, getting a guilty plea, being out of jail 5 years later, and living his life like nothing ever happened. That usually happens to drug dealers. That usually happens to burglars where there's a nonviolent act in that burglary. I don't think that this law is going to do anything but give the victims in Pennsylvania a right that they should have had all along, and which I hope they all take part and use that right for not only their future but for the memories of their loved ones if they in fact lost them.
A lot of other issues that are being dealt with in Harrisburg, the state house just moved a privatization bill for the liquor system. I want to get your take on that, and I hope that the Senate does something with it. Well, we'll have to wait and see. And there are a lot of other issues. Mike Verb is our guest on Commie and Fleas by Univest. We'll be back with more on this Friday afternoon in a moment. AM 1440, Commie and Fleas by Univest on this Friday afternoon. We have State Representative Mike Verb on the program. He's from the 150th District in Montgomery County. And a couple of other folks who I understand are regular guests on the program, State Representative Kate Harper and the District Attorney of Montgomery County, Risa Furman, both are celebrating birthdays today. Mike told me this, so I guess we should wish them a happy birthday.
You weren't supposed to tell the audience that I added their birthdays.
But Mike didn't tell me how old they were. If he knows, I'm not sure that he does. And if he does, he's not saying. So that's, the greatest thing that that Mike can do today. Some other things that are going on in Harrisburg, the state liquor legislation. Were you happy with the changes that were made? The governor had made a proposal, and that was altered in the House. And it seemed to me that this offered some more protection to the beer distributors. I've got my own favorite local beer distributor, Tomlinson Beverage, over here. Fine advertiser on the radio station. I'm glad they're being protected a little bit more than they might have been under the initial proposal. But where is it going to go in the state Senate, do you think?
Well, I think the Senate's going to do something, and specifically along the lines of choice, of convenience and choice for the consumer. You know, one of the soft spots in this for me is the store system. You know, they do great work. The employees have done great work over so many decades for the state. And I know that people are really gung-ho to eliminate the stores. I don't know what's going to come back from the Senate. I did vote for the bill that went over to the Senate. And part of the purpose is to make sure we generate the conversation of choice. Look, our consumers, whether we like it or not, the iPhones do everything for them. We are a society of convenience. People do want to go to grocery stores, and they want to be able to purchase alcohol.
Right.
You know, I was just recently on vacation in Florida with a family, and, you know, it's in Wawa's down there and in the convenience stores. I don't know that we really want that here in Pennsylvania, but I do think people want to be able to access alcohol in their grocery stores.
Now, people are less and less willing to put up with an inconvenience.
Sure.
Relatively mild inconvenience.
As much as the current wine and spirit stores have tried to make themselves convenient with Sunday hours expanded, you know, standalone stores, I just think the conversation is going to embark in the Senate as early as next week in terms of what they think they can get, you know, 26 votes for in the Senate to send back to the House.
Mm-hmm.
Do I expect them to run our bill and pass it and, you know, send it to the governor? No, we would have never expected that. And frankly, every bill, including the Raphael Robb bill, it's very plain clean. There was a technical fix needed that it'll be amended and sent back. So I envision something coming back amended And at that point, we got to decide as House leadership, you know, what we want to send to the governor. Do we want to play this back and forth game? Is it going to be okay? And I think that that's for weeks to come. That's for certainly for another show.
Well, will we be able to say that we're out of the liquor business, or do you envision Pennsylvania still playing a role in the distribution of some level of booze?
You know, I take a line from the governor. I'm not going to negotiate myself against myself in public. I don't know. You know, like, I'm not going to be critical to Senate. I think that it's not easy to get to 26 votes. And I think there's going to be franchise reform, in terms of what is available where from a beer perspective. I think there are senators that want that. And frankly, House members. You know, this debate really brought out the ugliness of how a bottle of beer or alcohol gets to your house. In terms of, it's not just the UFCW. And I mean, they educate us on how well they are doing and how many employees are impacted. They weren't an issue here. They object to it and they fought hard against it. But the real issue here is how a bottle of beer leaves the brewery and how it gets to your house. And it's almost as I defined it in anger a couple of weeks ago, as if like a cult, a little mob organization of where beer will be sold and how it will be sold.
Right.
It's not by our breweries. It's not by our PA breweries, who actually pay the price for the bigger breweries from out of our state and their influence with these distributors. So I think there's a lot of franchise reform coming. I'm going to push for that, and we'll see what the Senate actually sends back to us.
One of the frustrations, it seems to me that, of course, there's a inertia, which goes on, political inertia in Harrisburg, I guess maybe in other state capitals too. But this always seemed to be a union issue, that if the unions did not have as organized an opposition to it, it would happen. We'd get out of the liquor business. A lot of that has to do with education reform. A lot of that has to do with pension reform, that the unions don't want it. They want the status quo. Unions used to be fighting for their employees. Now they're sort of maintaining status quo. It seems to me a lot of this, and I think that's the frustration some people have, the perception at least, that it's really a relatively small group of people that are stopping something from happening.
Well, you know, and I got to tell you, maybe going in a few weeks ago, I might have agreed with you, but I will tell you, the UFCW and Wendell Young have, you know, first of all, he's a constituent of mine. They have been nothing but constructive in their fight against this. This has not been, you know, harassment and all kind of, you know, the typical things people talk about.
So you're saying it could have gone another way that it didn't?
No, they were very respectful. And look, they're there to report facts, educate members of facts. They were homegrown lobbyists doing what they had to do. The thing that really disturbed me, and I'm not going to mention it, I think I've already threatened to be sued over it, but, you know, the fact that a can of beer, a bottle of beer, goes through what it goes through to get to our houses or actually our local distributors.
Yeah.
That's where it became very ugly, because now you're not fighting about consumer choice.
Mm-hmm.
You're fighting about your right to control what beer goes where. And that's what really became ugly. See, UFCW, they're fighting for members' jobs, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're fighting to protect people's benefits, and they're fighting to protect the great job that they've done over the last several decades in this Commonwealth. I learned a lot about beer. And I learned a lot about all the nonsense that a can of beer goes through to get to our house. And I will tell you, I know that Senator Rafferty has worked on franchise reform. Our chairman, John Taylor, would like franchise reform. And I think it's going to be a big part of it coming back. So this is not a union issue. It is a union issue. Make no mistake. It's a priority of them.
Sure.
But they were very well organized and were doing the job that they thought they could do to help influence negative votes on a bill.
But do you think on something like pension reform that the union obviously is trying to maintain the status quo, the state workers and teachers, and they want to maintain the status quo, when it seems to me that there are common sense reforms to the pension system that aren't getting done just because of this well-organized opposition?
Well, I remember, part of that opposition is the General Assembly itself, you know, sitting in the same pension plan. So I think that a lot of people are in favor of doing something moving forward, including a number of the major unions. They're willing to talk about that, and I think that that's the first practical point. We didn't create this. I certainly was not involved in creating this pension boom and balloon that we're in. And frankly, a Republican governor did have something to do with it. We do have to figure a way out of it. And I don't think there's one answer, and I don't think it's going to be a one-year answer, and I don't think it's an answer that we can put off any longer. We have to start working to moving people into different pension plans moving forward. What that is, how it happens, we're very early in the sausage-making process of pension mm-hmm. reform. I will tell you the House is taking it very seriously and working on a number of reforms. But what, you know, in terms of taking existing benefits off of current employees, taking their plan away from them as they sit, having an impact on their past benefits, you know, good luck getting 102 votes in the House and 26 in the Senate, because it's going to involve, obviously, the General Assembly as well.
I mean, they're big union issues like, you know, right to work and other things that I think ought to be tackled. And some of this other stuff should be easier than it is, but none of it's easy. And I don't know what's going to get done. But I want to get to something else before we run out of time, because I want to spend some time talking about some things that are going on. Yesterday's Philadelphia Inquirer front page, federal grand jury probing Delaware River Port Authority. And earlier in the week, there was the new Turnpike CEO welcoming scrutiny after it was determined that there was rampant, and for some of us, not terribly surprising, corruption going on. Not that the Turnpike was any worse than some of these other commissions or authorities, but the autonomy that they have and has been created for them, to me, is almost like a welcome mat for corruption or misuse or overspending.
Well, on the first pitch, how about a swing away at the DRPA?
Okay, let's do it.
I have spent a better part of my legislative career smashing John Matheson and the DRPA for the very publicly known corruption that's been going on there. The money that has been spent, the toll payers' money, $5 now to cross that bridge to go to work, whether you live in Jersey and come to Pennsylvania or vice versa.
Now, this is a creature, too, of New Jersey and Pennsylvania.
Oh, sure it is.
Right.
And this is not just a Pennsylvania issue. Right. Pennsylvania can't do anything without Jersey on board. The reality of it is the tolls have gone up. 50 cents of every dollar that each person pays across that bridge, 50 cents of every dollar goes to debt. Why are we getting involved in Kimmel Centers and all these other publicly reported capital improvements that are nowhere near any of these bridges?
They were designating projects to finance.
It was other people's money. I mean,
right.
This is, you're going to find with this grand jury report, I wrote a letter to the U.S. attorney and was co-authored with Dominic DiCicco, a former assemblyman in the Jersey Assembly. He had the other side of the bridge. We did a joint press conference in Camden right in front of their building, and it was about this very issue. And we sent a letter to the U.S. attorney asking him to investigate what's going on with the DRPA. It did start in the Inspector General's office in Jersey, and we had become aware that people were sniffing around about the DRPA. And let me tell you, I hope that the U.S. attorney put the strings around the ankles on the people at the DRPA that are might not even be there anymore. I hope they do it as hard to the ankles of the people responsible for this debt as the board has done in the past to raise the fees crossing that bridge and these people. $5, that's you figure it's $25 to cross a bridge a week to go to work. Forget about the commuters and forget about the people doing it just to go to the shore. It has an impact. People just can't afford this. And I think that the DRPA, I mean, you know, obviously the governor come in and put new members on the board, and they're working for reforms and future reforms. Most of what you see in this report mm-hmm. is the stuff that we knew of at the time that had gone on in the past. There's no more capital money left. In fact, I think they're borrowing more money to keep up with some of the projects they had started. But, you know, there's things like the bridge to nowhere. In the middle of the Delaware River, there's pilings in the ground for a train that was supposed to go across the Delaware. That project was stopped. There were reports of people sleeping on jobs, people stealing from toll booths down at the Commodore Barry Bridge that were then put over to the ship terminal that never had any cruise ships going in and out of it, and that person was paid big money. You can go to my website and find a lot about the DRPA story. So I was very enlightened and happy and felt that something actually was going to happen to the infrastructure of the DRPA. And needless to say, you're going to see a reform package come out for myself and Senator Rafferty on a DRPA soon.
So just to dig in a little bit deeper, I mean, people would say, well, why are they financing all these other projects? Why are they creating jobs? Why are they creating projects to nowhere? Well, it's an accumulation of money and political sway, and all of this tends to kick back at some point for individuals. Do you think that a probe like this is going to identify a handful of individuals, 1,000 individuals who are benefiting from all these projects?
I'm not in the grand jury. I think the grand jury is going to answer that. And I don't know, anybody that walks out of this grand jury and tries to go back and pay that $5 crossing the bridge, they're probably going to want to jump off of it. I think a presentment will be handed down, and I think people will be indicted. And I think some of the people, frankly, are already in jail for other corruption charges. So, I don't want to lean or, kind of point fingers at people, but the reality of it is $5 Right. Of that, $2.50 goes to debt. And this is the bridges. And the bridges are not in the greatest of shape. If they were the pristine and you still have the old toll booths, the old toll gates, and look, we fought it, and we're just glad it's in the hands of the grand jury. And unfortunately, the reforms will only come when a grand jury indicts.
Let's talk about the and again, you know, we talk about the Delaware River Port Authority. We talk about the Turnpike Commission. There are all sorts of authorities and commissions and boards that are, you know, given a certain amount of autonomy, supposedly to keep, you know, political fingers out of them. But it's created a separation that has we've lost accountability with some of these groups, and the Turnpike Commission is now become an obvious example of that.
Well, we saw the indictment that the investigation that was started a number of years ago by then Attorney General Corbett, and Kathleen Kane just announced the presentment or the indictments or arrest of people to Turnpike.
Right.
Look, I do think under the new Inspector General that they hired, there's a lot of work going on the Turnpike to try to straighten some of this out. I do think that the board is focusing on that. You know, the question becomes, you know, what do we do long term now?
And you want to pull them out into the light a little bit.
Well, 3-4 years ago, I stood very lonely at a podium. And if you read my press releases back then, you may have thought I authored the grand jury report, because people were calling my office telling me what was going on there. And what I wanted to do in my bill was to move the Turnpike Commission, eliminate it, and put the operation of the Turnpike under a Deputy Secretary of Toll Administration with PennDOT. Now, some people will say, oh, another bureaucrat operation. But guess what? PennDOT managed, you know, billions of dollars in federal stimulus money in projects. They bid work out. PennDOT's rather well regulated in terms of how they proceed with projects. And you know, that's under the state scrutiny. It's under the right to know law. It's under the Inspector General's purview. And we just feel that they were doing a much better job. Now, that was under Governor Rendell, and it was under, you know, obviously Democrat leadership. And I think there's a lot of Democrats that kind of like this approach. Representative Overlander is going to be introducing a bill similar to mine, and we'll see if it makes it through transportation or not. I don't want to, you know, be too critical of the brand new people that are running there. Craig Shuey, he's been there, he's been in touch. You know, they're trying their best to do some of these reforms. Some of this stuff is water over the dam, and it's unretrievable. It's just spilt milk that a grand jury is just catching up with.
But going forward, a level of accountability that hasn't existed seems to make some sense.
There have been better communication since my press conference with the Turnpike, and frankly, one of the commissioners from down here. But I do think you're going to see a desire for some movement with the Turnpike down the road. And not to be critical of current people, but certainly of the past practices that were identified in a grand jury report.
And I don't know that it has anything to do with anything, but I know that the project that is going on now to widen the Turnpike between Lansdale and the Mid-County is way behind schedule, and it's over budget to a certain degree, and I know the state's going to take steps at making sure that certain funds are recouped, which makes a lot of sense. But I just wonder if the level of accountability that the Turnpike Commission has had generally maybe leads to something like this. There seems to be maybe a connection. I don't know.
Well, that Northeast Extension expansion, both Senator Rafferty and Representative Harper have been working with residents. There's a lot of environmental issues there. There's sound wall issues. There's going to be overruns on projects. There's no doubt about it, especially a job that big. I think the focus has got to be on the right to know and on the exposure. You know, Penn Live is a new website for all state expenditures. You can find out salaries of people in our offices. It's all online now. It's all very public.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we just got to get the Turnpike to that position. But I do think there is an urge, especially from people in my caucus, to move legislation to basically eliminate the commission. Now, let's make this clear. The intent is not to eliminate employees working at Turnpike or their contracts or their labor agreements with the Turnpike Commission. It's to eliminate the management structure of that Turnpike. And I was kind of shocked. I'd given up this fight a few years ago and begin to develop trust in the system. While this report was news to a lot of people, frankly, it was not news to me, and I know that there's been a lot of things done since then to move into a brighter future with a Turnpike. Understand, Darrell, we have to take ownership of the fact that with Act 44, which is the I-80 program, I mean, that a large portion of the debt that the Turnpike's currently deal with was generated by the legislature, and frankly, I was one of those people pushing for the I-80 tolling. But the issue then becomes, you know, what do we do now? You know, the Turnpike's operating with this debt. This is not all brought on by themselves. So we do have to accept responsibility for what decisions were made back then. But they're going to continue to plug away, and we'll see if the legislation moves.
Are there other commissions or authorities that you think should be looked at more closely that maybe should come under maybe more direct purview? And I don't know how difficult it is to get rid of a commission or an authority. I'm probably thinking it's not easy to do. But are there some other areas where you think there ought to at least be a closer look and maybe more accountability?
You know, the DRPA is very hard because it is you need New Jersey. The way it's set up, both states need
right.
each other.
Right.
One can't just do and take over the whole entire DRPA. The Pennsylvania Turnpike Commission is, you know, 102 votes in the House, 26 votes in the Senate, and a signature by the governor. That's a lot easier. And I'm not saying it's easy. I'm just saying that is a lot easier because it's just Pennsylvania. The Joint Toll Bridge Commission, that's further up the river. I know there are a lot of problems my colleagues are having with the Joint Toll Bridge Commission, but I don't know much about the issues up there. We look at our transportation systems, SEPTA and the Allegheny Transit Authority. I got to tell you, SEPTA's received awards. I remember the days where you'd park behind a SEPTA bus at a stop and it takes off and plumes of black smoke come out. They have changed a lot of that. They're looking at the hybrid busing. I mean, they're not looking at them. They're deploying them. I think SEPTA is really working hard to recognize the needs of public transportation in our suburbs. And I think we're getting a decent bang for a buck out of SEPTA and its management. If you ask people west of here, they think SEPTA is, you know, the worst thing ever that existed in human habitat. And part of that's because the Southeast did pretty well with Governor Rendell back in the day. So I can tell you, Allegheny has a lot of problems up there, a lot of problems with our leader, Mike Terzai, is demanding a lot of reforms in Allegheny system. But I think that some of our systems are doing well, and the ones that aren't are certainly going to be called to our attention, and we're going to be looking to address them. I don't know that we are the experts in all of this. I do think it is very important to have private sector people involved in running some of these operations, and let's just hope that down the road that we're not dealing with grand jury presentments to then get legislation to fix some of these groups. Let's just hope that we can take some private sector advice and look for improvements.
All right, we're going to take another break. We'll be back with the final few minutes with State Representative Mike Varable. We will continue on Comment Please by Univest in a moment.
WNPV AM 1440.
And we're back on Comment Please by Univest. Just a couple of minutes left with State Representative Mike Varable. And we were talking during the break about the governor met with Kathleen Sebelius the other night down in Washington, D.C. The governor has not said or has said previously that he was not getting enough answers about expanding, really opening up Pennsylvania's Medicaid to the federal health care overhaul, for lack of a better term. So do you think that Kathleen Sebelius was able to change his mind? I guess he still has some reservations post that meeting.
Well, you know, from my conversations, the reality of it is he's looking for answers to questions. And I don't think it was an arm twisting as much as I think that from my understanding of people in that meeting that, she was educated on just how in depth things are here in Pennsylvania. I think that perhaps what he was looking for is, what's this going to look like 4 or 5 years from now? Whether, you know, it's year five, year six, he's not going to be around regardless as governor at that point. You know, who's going to be paying for this? How are things going to be in Pennsylvania?
I don't think Kathleen Sebelius knows the answer to those questions.
Well, and, you know, I think he has a duty to get answers to reasonable questions before he makes any decision. I mean, he's already said that he's not for the expansion based on the information he had at the time. And, look, it's going to be the federal government's job to compel him to make it that Pennsylvania's going to be better. Look, this involves vulnerable people here in Pennsylvania. And this is not a conservative or a moderate or a liberal decision. This is a decision that involves people's lives. And we've got to get away from this partisan sphere that exists within parties and between parties. And that's what he's trying to do with this issue. Find out what it's going to cost, who's going to pay for it long term, and what the impact is either negative or positive going to have on Pennsylvania. And I don't think you can ask anything more than a person to do the research. I think that's what's going on right now.
Although it sounds like you would be surprised if he changed course. There's so many uncertainties surrounding this whole healthcare thing. Who knows where we're going to be in 5 years?
The one thing you don't do with Tom Corbett is think you know what he's going to do. He's going to do his research. He's going to get answers to his questions, and he's going to make a decision. So far, all of his decisions have been exactly what he said he was going to do in a campaign. And they're not easy decisions. We don't have the money in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania that we're to be able to hand out to legislators like we did before. He stopped whams. And I just think in this very decision, it's very complicated, and I think he's going to make the decision he feels best for Pennsylvania.
We're running out of time to really get into it, but do you think the budget is going to be as difficult to get through as it was the last couple of years?
Look, I think we're still, you know, we're still, we're doing a little bit better in the Commonwealth. I think we'll get it done on time, but no budget. No budget's easy. It's a matter of priorities. And I think that they're already negotiating, you know, all the appropriation hearings are done. We'll work towards getting to a spend number and work our way backwards on how we're going to fund programs. I mean, I'm really focused on the mentally ill and certainly a long-term care facility at Park House. Make sure we have, try to get more money for them.
The aforementioned website for Mike Verib, for people that want to find out more about some of the authority stuff that we talked about?
Rep Verib, REPVERIB.com, and then look under press releases or the video stuff from the DRPA.
Always appreciate the time. Thanks for coming in.
Glad to be here.
Mike Verib, state representative, joining us on the program today. Stay tuned. Coming up next, it's the Clark Howard radio program.